In this lesson about how difficult it is to follow Jesus. And if you were not here last week, you're kind of just going to have to catch up quickly. It's kind of like skiing off the dock. By the time the rope gets to you, we're going 40. And so Jesus, we've said, was functioning according to a different set of assumptions than most of us are functioning according to. He intuited something profound about the nature of reality, and he did it a long time ago. And it took the mystics and it took the physicists a long time to figure out what Jesus intuited a long time ago. And it was basically that everything is connected. It was basically the idea of oneness instead of two-ness. And that's kind of what we're talking about in this lesson. With that fundamental premise that everything is connected, he was saying in most, hey, there's my son. And he's late. But isn't he good looking? He's leaving for Chile in a couple of weeks, and so we're glad to have him around the house. yeah, what was I talking about? Yes, that's right. That's right. What was going on underneath most of Jesus' very well-known teachings wasn't just, hey, this is a good idea, you should do this. It was, hey, there's an undergirding reality from which all of these ideas come. So when Jesus says you can take the mountain and throw it into the sea, it's because you are somehow very connected to the mountain in a way that you don't understand. When he says love your neighbor as yourself, it's because loving your neighbor is loving yourself. When love your enemy with the same passion with which you love yourself. And all of these realities are rooted in a fundamental undergirding that says there is a connection to a everything to the other thing that we don't always intuit in our separateness realities. And so to understand Jesus, we need the same lenses on with which he was looking. Paul came along and expanded upon Jesus' teaching and reinforced it by saying in the passage we looked at last week, we are, a good way to think about this is being a body. Yes, there is a difference between hand and elbow, but in a deeper understanding, hand and elbow are a oneness. They are all part of a body. And in that same way, we think of ourselves as connected one to another, as part of one another. So the hand can't win at the expense of the elbow. The hand has to win in concert with the elbow. And so if I'm having an argument with Denise and I think to myself that I can beat her in an argument without caring for the well-being of her, it doesn't end up working well because I have to argue in such a way that I get what is good for me and what is good for her, because we have to think of ourselves as a oneness system. That's what we'll be looking at when we get to the conflict resolution module this summer on Wednesday evenings. So I want to pick up where we left off last week. And if you missed, and this does seem like a strange notion to you, you go ahead online and you can get caught up very quickly. Just put in oneness and it'll bring up several lessons to get you caught up. So, we are not born able to apprehend oneness. We grow into it over time. Now, counterintuitively, we were actually born with a juvenile sense of oneness. If you know who Piaget was, this cognitive development guy from some time ago, he tells us that when an infant is born, the infant is undifferentiated. What that means is when the infant moves its arms, the universe moves its arms. And it takes a while for the infant to figure out that, wait a minute, I am over here with need, and mom is over there with meeting of need. So there must be me, and there must be not me. And that begins the process of differentiation. And then through the process of our childhood, we get more and more differentiated. When by the time we're into our twos, we don't think that we are the universe, but the universe belongs to us. So we say, mine, mine, mine. And so then as we move further along the path, we're building up these ego boundaries that separate us into a world in which now we've arrived and we say, I am me and you are you. And that is the first part of this journey. So we grow into this process of moving from that stage into the same oneness that Jesus was able to intuit through a series of thinking stages. When we start off, we think in what I'm calling the "what I am me, you are you" stage. We could use the ego-differentiated self stage, or we could talk about the false self stage. There's a lot of words we could use for it, but it's basically the fundamental idea that I am over here, you are over there, the tree is over there, and we're all separate entities. And we live in that. Hopefully we live well in that for a while. Then we move into the oneness stage where we understand that everything is connected and we realize that this is in a fundamental way very true. And then the surprising stage is that when we go to the third stage, we don't disappear in our individuality. We simply take ego and we submerge it into service to the divine agenda or the kingdom of God, as Jesus said. But we're not to the second and third stages yet. We're still looking at the first stage. So what we've seen along the way is that building up a strong ego self of personality and of strength and of gift, developing this gives us a deep and abiding sense of belonging and a deep and abiding sense of being valued. And that, it turns out, is going to be an essential ingredient in our need to move on to the next stages, because the second stage, as we're going to see, is quite chaotic and it's quite tumultuous and it is very difficult. It is an unraveling that feels like death. Jesus used the term, unless a grain of wheat falls into the ground and dies, it will not bear fruit, which is a way of talking about an ancient wisdom that says, unless the ego self is transcended, unless the I am me, you are you self dies out, we're not going to move into what we call the truth self or the divine center self and the self that Jesus very clearly lived from, as have several of our saints through the years. This journey is going to be very difficult. And we're going to need to be rooted in a sense of belonging, and we're going to need to be rooted in a sense of being valued. And we saw that the way to get this strong ego self has to do with figuring out how the world works and then working it. We figure out the principles and rules of life, and then we work those principles to our advantage. And thus advantaged, we get a sense of belonging and a sense of place. Now, the problem with figuring out how the world works is that every generation comes along and tells you this is what works. In our particular society, what we're being told is that consumerism works. So if you're going to be a really good consumer, you have to go out and earn a lot of money so you can buy a lot of stuff. And then now you have arrived and now that works. But that very short-sighted understanding of what works doesn't take into account the wisdom of those many, many generations who have gone before us, who have already tried that, and they've already said, yeah, we tried that, that doesn't work. Now here we are, we're reinventing the wheel, we're trying it again, and it's not working for us. But so to understand the way life works, we need more than just a snapshot of the culture we live in today, because somebody will tell you that if you've got the right size butt, or if you've got the right size abs, or if you've got the right size bank account, or if you've got granite countertops, or if you've got some such thing, then you've made it work, and it is working for you. And only to find how shallow and empty that is, so we need to reference something that's rooted in something bigger and deeper and longer. And that, it turns out, is the ancient wisdom of the virtues. And the virtues we've come to see in this last lesson are what we work so that life works for us. We figure out how relationships work, and then we work that way. And relationships, it ends up, works because of honesty and transparency and all of these very demanding and very difficult virtues, and we are constrained into them, and we work the virtues, and then the virtues give us a sense of belonging because they work. We learn about diligence, and then we work diligence. We learn about integrity, and then we work integrity. We learn these ancient ways, then we apply them to our lives, and that gives us a sense of, oh, wow, this is a sane and rational universe. Oh, wow, most of the time these things work for me. Oh, wow, I belong. Oh, wow, I'm valuable. Now, it's going to turn out in the end that that's not true. It's going to turn out in the end that I am not valuable because of anything I do or don't do. That's going to be part of the deconstructing of self. But for this time, we need to think that we are valuable because this is what we have figured out. These ancient virtues work, and they make us safe. Okay, that's a little bit of review to help us as we're now going to put a little bit of texture on what it's like to be in this first stage of the journey. Next slide, please. I grew up in this culture, as most of you did. And because I grew up as an American, I learned, as many of you did, a healthy disregard for tradition. As Americans, it is our way to question tradition. It's one of the things that makes us unique among nations. We question the way it's always been done. That's what we do. Disregard of tradition has been the milk that we have been weaned on. And then, after having that hammered out on the frontier and coming to the new world and figuring out the new way, then came the 60s. And when the 60s came, we reinforced that to an even greater degree by the whole idea of questioning authority and authority sources. So, as a result, there are very few cultures at any time in history who have had more than us a devaluation of law, or a devaluation of the rules, or a devaluation of tradition, or a devaluation of the customs, or a devaluation of authority figures. It's what we do better than just about anybody. Now, people who live in old world cultures, people to whom I have spoken, they see this about us and they envy us, parts of us. You Americans, they say, if a tradition constrains you, well, then you just break out of that, and that is wonderful. That is just wonderful. And in many ways, it has been wonderful. The creativity and the boundless optimism and the energy that has been part of the American ethic has been rooted in our questioning of tradition. But as we're seeing in our study of the Enneagram, every gift has a dark side. There is a place where you go and you gain and you gain and you gain, but you push that gain just one step too far and now you begin to lose. Every nutrient put into the wrong context becomes a toxin, and that's just the way this thing works. And the ancient wisdom, the ancient virtues, and the ancient ways are part of a tradition. And it is a nutrient-rich soil in which healthy ego selves grow. And when we throw out the whole process of the tradition, we throw out something that is absolutely essential for this first stage of growth. So when our American ethic assumes that we can disregard tradition with impunity, we experiment with new boundaries and we try new things, two things happen. One of them is great. The great thing that happens is that the toxic traditions get deconstructed. It was once a tradition to disenfranchise the other in some form or another, to disenfranchise the slave or women or the Irish or gay people or Mexican people. And at some time in American history, it has been the traditional way to outgroup all of these people. And praise be to God that we have, or we are in the process of, abandoning these traditions. And that is one of the strengths that we have as Americans. But on the other hand, there are times when disregarding tradition is not good. The virtues provide this curriculum for ego development, and without regard for and respect for this curriculum, we don't gain the security and the belonging that we need. We don't gain that sense of place that we had talked about. We don't experience the self-control being exercised by a society toward us, and we don't become carriers of that same self-control that is exercised toward others through us, and our worlds become chaotic. Everyone does what they want when they want, and that makes it dangerous. And in a dangerous world, we fear. And we hide, and we protect ourselves, and we don't run with abandon, and we don't develop what it takes that we are going to need later on the journey. In the second lesson last week, Robin brought up the teaching by Jesus, where Jesus said that he didn't come to abolish the law, but to fulfill the law. And I think in many ways that is exactly what we're talking about here. The law is not bad. It's just insufficient to take us the whole journey. The law is rooted here in an understanding of this first part of the journey as an essential ingredient on the journey to oneness. Now, mine was a very strict upbringing. There were clear ethics, and there were clear values, and there were clear boundaries. Right and wrong were very clearly defined. And if there were 100 things that I was taught at that stage in my life, I've probably only had to rebel against and eject 5 of those 100. It turns out that God doesn't hate Catholics or Mexicans or gay people. I didn't know. But the 95 that I kept and the 95 that I was able to embrace, I've been able to pass on to my own children. Hopefully I won't pass on to them 5 of my own blind spots, but probably I will, because every one of us is historically conditioned to some point of blindness, and I will try my best not to pass them on, but I probably will. But what I gained and what I pass on is a powerful and profound thing, because it has shaped me, and I watch it shaping my children into a sense of strong ego self. Now, that idea is not particularly popular in the American ethos today, but we cannot start each generation, every one of us, at zero. We cannot reinvent the wheel solely on the basis of personal experience. Life is too short to learn it all by making our own mistakes. We need to learn from the mistakes of the generations who have gone before us. People long before us figured out how relationships work, and they figured out how social systems work, and they figured out how to fail, and they figured out how to recover. When my kids were young, I read to them a lot. And one time I picked up a copy of a book long before I'd ever heard of it on television or anything that was in a used bookstore about, it was a collection of Grimm's fairy tales. And I thought, fairy tales, kids, we should read these things. So I started reading Grimm's fairy tales to my kids. And Denise would be in the other room and she would hear reading and she said, "What? What did you just read to my children?" Because there were stories of great challenges being set before very young children, and there were stories about the severe consequences that would come if they failed life's challenges, and there were stories about great injustices and unfairnesses being perpetrated on children and how they had to navigate a world in order to make right what had gone wrong, and if they didn't get it right, they would be imprisoned or taken away from their family and sold into indentured servitude to the troll who lived under the bridge, or some such thing. They would be boiled in oil, or, you know, some really eaten, fattened up to be eaten. Those are really awful things that happen if they didn't get it right. And this is when Denise would say, "What? What are you reading to my children?" But those ancient stories bake failure and bake it's going to go wrong right into the cake. They say it's going to go wrong, and you're going to get it wrong. And you're going to have to learn how to recover when that happens. You're going to face an injustice. You're going to face an unfairness. You're going to face something very hard and difficult. And your character is what's going to get you to the other side. You're going to suffer. Suffering is part of life. And you're going to have to learn how to rise from the ashes when everything burns down. You're going to have to learn to get to the other side and to overcome. You're going to have to learn that failure can be overcome, dilemmas can be solved, and here is a set of laws, and here's a set of virtues, and here's a set of principles that you can use when that happens. And this is how you're going to get to the other side. And along the way, when you thrive in the midst of that chaos, when you overcome that which you thought could not be overcome, you're going to be hammering out a healthy ego self. And so law serves us well. Tradition serves us well. And we need good law. And we need good tradition. But interestingly, we also need bad law. And we need bad tradition. We need these because they give us something to kick against, and kicking against, it turns out, is really going to be important to us. We need to test our mettle. We need a tradition because a tradition is a strong opponent. A tradition is a worthy opponent. I sometimes teach my kids, you're going to have to fight me because you need the fight. You need to come to believe what you believe. We need something that is strong and ancient that we find lacking so that we can learn how to trust our own interior compass and go up against it. So it's helpful when we fight bad tradition. It's also helpful when we fight what we think is bad tradition only to live a little bit longer and then circle back around and say, oh yeah, tradition was a little smarter than I thought it was. We need that the same way that a butterfly needs to push its way out of the cocoon, because a hearty ego structure is what's being hammered out when we work the law to our advantage and when we kick against the law because it has become unjust. And when our culture and when our families take tradition away, we have nothing to work to our advantage, and we have nothing to fight against to give us this strength for the journey. We don't just need the rules to work for our advantage. We also need the rules so that we have something to fight. Because kicking, it turns out, internalizes values more than just about anything. So if you're a parent and you're creating a system for your child that child has to fight against, and if it is particularly if it is a wise or if it's a prudent system and it's not an abusive one, but even if you get it wrong sometimes in your efforts to do right, the struggle that you give your child is a gift. It's the gift of developing that healthy ego within. And if you talk to the minister, and if he says something like, you're pissing your gifts away and you're playing it too safe, and you get out there and you need to prove that you to yourself that you could do something, and he says these kinds of things, he does love you. He really does. It's not a bad thing. We need the law. We need the tradition. Sometimes we need it because it teaches us the way of the world, and we learn to work that way to our advantage. And sometimes it acts as a foil for us to fight against, to hammer out our own values and our own beliefs and our own ego structure. So we do joke with our kids from time to time when we're being particularly tough on them. We say, well, you can get therapy when you grow up, but right now do what I said. So a caveat, because that's tough talk. Now let me give you a caveat. And particularly for women. Women have been the brunt of a great and toxic distortion of this truth. Because submission to a tradition is a very important tool for developing an ego self. But women, and the poor, and the non-dominant race, and the uneducated, and the out-grouped, throughout history, these and other non-power groups have been taught some sick version of submitting to a tradition, and it's been called that, and they've been taught it at the end of a stick. Now, what was taught was a lot of things, but it was not submission to a tradition. What was taught was subjugation. What was taught was a cheap and convenient tool to dominate. Now, the ancient ways do teach us to die to ourselves. That is true. And the ancient ways do teach us to take up our crosses and follow Jesus. This is true. And they do teach us to lay aside our self in service to a greater good. That is true. But when this truth is distorted, it is usually distorted in a way of maintaining the power base of those who are on top at the moment. We use this tool in order to tell you, don't bother us, it's working fine for us. And particularly when religion participates in this, it becomes the greatest bastardization of a pure and true and powerful truth. And so, some people hear the words that I'm saying about tradition and about honoring the rules and about honoring the ancient ways, and they have experienced injustice that was masquerading as tradition, and they just want to vomit, and they should. So we have to be careful with this truth. It's a powerful tool, and it can aid our souls. And we have to be careful with this truth because it's a powerful tool, and it will destroy our souls. Only an ego that exists can be asked to surrender. Only a soul that feels preferred can be asked to lay aside its preferred status. Only an ego that is valuable can voluntarily value another above itself. Only an ego that is precious can be sacrificed. Only an ego that is wonderful can be crucified. Sacrifice is critical to the development of a healthy self. It's critical to a healthy family, to a healthy school, to a healthy church, to healthy companies, to healthy neighborhoods, to a healthy society. Service and sacrifice is an essential ingredient, but coercion and control are not sacrifice. And we surrender from a foundation of a healthy place of belonging. We surrender from a foundation of a healthy place of being valued. Now here's the rule of the difference between surrender and subjugation. It depends on who it's happening for. Sacrifice and surrender and submission, these benefit the young. They benefit the shaping ego. They don't benefit the power structure. The purpose of this is, you can tell whether it's working when you realize, is this purpose intended to benefit the emerging ego, or is it to enforce the system of the power structure? So when the principle or the law or the tradition is a thin veneer over domination, reject it, we must. But we've been doing that for a long time. That's the American way. We've rejected a lot of stuff. And we've sometimes fallen prey to that axiom I use from time to time: if you've been bitten by a snake, you're afraid of a rope. And sometimes we've thrown out the bathwash and we've thrown the baby out with it. And it's going to require of us the capacity to discern. Because any time a tradition imposes upon us and constrains us, it feels like a power structure that's trying to service itself. And so it's very difficult to discern and to understand how to walk this fine path. And so I'm going to suggest to us as a society, we need to, for a while, hear the honor tradition message. Because we've heard the disregard tradition well. And we've seen the dangers that come with domination. And we are very prone to reject that and to push that away and to dismiss it as irrelevant. And I'm going to suggest that when you feel domination, you might be feeling the constraint and the limits that are required of a wise tradition that is asking you to live differently and asking you to live a way you don't want to live. So finally, this thing is a cycle, and you can be on either side of this cycle. On the one side, it's going to be a vicious down-tearing cycle. On the other side, it's going to be a reinforcing and upbuilding cycle. So consider this. If you want someone competent to do a job, if you want someone who takes responsibility and who doesn't make excuses, or if you want a virtuous friend who will be kind and good in your relationship, or if you want someone relationally sensitive to build the community that you are a part of, then you're going to need someone who has faced limits. You're going to need someone who has faced the constraints of a wise tradition, someone who has been restricted in their behaviors so they couldn't do willy-nilly whatever it is they wanted to, but they had to follow the limits of the ancient wisdom, because somehow that person who has faced difficult challenges and who's had to go up against these things that have been hard is going to be capable in meeting the needs of your company or your relationship. Virtue training and training in limits is training in how life works, and the people who have worked them have learned how life works. and under the tutelage of the wise tradition, or by kicking against the unwisdom of the tradition, we gain a sense of place and we gain a sense of value. We learn resilience and we learn character and we learn strength of ego that we need to make life work for us. And because of that, we get hired for the job. Or we get invited to the spiritual friendship. Or we get to hang out with others who have been strengthening themselves, and we become a mutually strengthening community, and we get asked to the table. So when we have faced limits, and when we have honored the tradition, we get invited to the table, which serves to reinforce the interior sense of self, and serves to reinforce the strength of ego, and it becomes a mutually reinforcing cycle. Or when we do not face the limitations of the ancient ways, and we do not develop the competencies that come with that, and we do not learn how to make life work to our advantage, and we do not learn the ancient ways of relationships and the ancient ways of integrity and the ancient ways of the virtues, we do not get invited to the table, which also serves as a reinforcing belief system, only now it begins to deconstruct the ego self. It begins to downgrade the value that we have of our belonging and of our value. And again, if we're going to go further into the reaches of this journey into oneness, we are going to need this strong ego self. And we are going to need the people around us to have strong ego selves. And we're going to need our family structures to have that, and our community structures, and our small group structures, and our life story group structures, and all the times we get together with people to be servicing and moving toward this virtue development world that works, ego boundaries that are secure self. We're going to need that environment because tumult is coming. Chaos is coming. Deconstruction is coming. And we won't be able to make it then without this now. So again, it's a long lesson, and that's a good place to stop for today. Next week, I'm going to challenge some of the ways that we think about this concept of unconditional love. And that should be fun. So Spirit of God, may we thrive in all the way stations on our journey, and may we learn how to work each one of these stages effectively, and may we do well on this journey into that same world of oneness in which Jesus lived. Be that so, Lord, in us, in Jesus' name.